Two stories of British intelligence during World War II.
During the period of the Allied invasion of North Africa, leading up to it from July 42 to November 42, my mother was suddenly given a very good job in her hut above the other women working there. And the interesting thing was that at the time, she actually wrote in the diary, "I will never have such an important job again."
That's Elisa Seagrave. Her book is The Girl from Station X, My Mother's Unknown Life. And we also hear my 2008 interview with Jenet Conant about her book, The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. How much do children really know their parents? So often, their understanding is clouded, especially when the relationship to the parent is a difficult one. Sometimes it's mere chance that opens a door to a fuller comprehension of who the parent is, or was, as a separate human being. That's what happened to writer Elisa Seagrave, who found the diaries her mother wrote as a young woman in pre-war and wartime Europe. At the time, Seagrave was caring for her elderly mother, who was stricken with Alzheimer's after decades of depression and alcoholism. But the young woman she discovered in the diaries was vivacious, charismatic, and had worked in the secret code-breaking section of the British Intelligence Service at Bletchley Park during World War II. Seagrave combines intimate family memoir with extensive material about the code-breaking work at Bletchley Park, at which her mother excelled, in her book, The Girl from Station X, My Mother's Unknown Life. Elisa Seagrave is the author of The Diary of a Breast, about her battle with cancer, and the novel, Ten Men. She writes for newspapers and magazines, including the London Review of Books, The Guardian, and The Independent. Elisa Seagrave, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Your book, The Girl from Station X, first explain to us, what is Station X?
Station X refers to Bletchley Park, which was the secret place during the war in the UK. My mother worked there for under 2 years, but at Bletchley Park, she had the most important job in her life.
But the book is not entirely about that. It's also very much about your relationship with your mother and what you discovered about her even after she had descended into Alzheimer's. What were the circumstances under which you discovered that your mother had a hidden history, or at least one that was hidden to you?
My mother had got Alzheimer's in about 91, 92. But even before that, she had become very helpless. She was an alcoholic. She had to be looked after. And she had to move house in 1997. And she was a hoarder. All her things had to be sorted out. And thank goodness, I then found the attic full of her diaries, many of them through the whole way through the Second World War and earlier ones from the age of 15. So there I had my mother's life recounted by her, all kind of secrets that I had never knew before. As a result of this, I began to be much more sympathetic to her.
Yeah, so elaborate on that. I mean, you had a very difficult relationship with your mom.
My mother was a childlike woman. She was absolutely charming to meet, highly intelligent. She would project herself when she was meeting strangers. She was very, very interested in them. But as a mother, she was very unmaternal, but she had a tragedy which made everything far worse. My brother was drowned on my 7th birthday. He was 5 in my grandmother's swimming pool, her mother's swimming pool. As a result of this, I don't think she ever fully recovered. And she, like many women do, I believe, when a child dies, she made the child a hero. So I think we felt rather ignored, I and my other two brothers, and I began to resent her for that reason, because she kind of withdrew from us.
Yeah, it's very painful to read that in your book, The Girl from Station X. Talk a little bit about your family background and how you grew up.
My mother was an heiress because her grandfather had made money in South America. He had gone out there as a very young man, following his older brother from Ireland out to Peru. They had worked in a ship chandler's in the port of Lima, Callao. And then they had realised that there was money to be made by anchoring a supply boat to the Chincha Islands, where all this guano was being exported as fertiliser. Anyway, as a result of that, my mother was an heiress. She had one little brother who was born disabled and died at three. So despite her material wealth, she was rather lonely, I think. She her father died also when she was, one. And so she was isolated in that way. We went to live in a big house after my father retired from the Navy when I was seven. Unfortunately, that was when, just after my brother was drowned. So this wonderful house we'd moved to in the English countryside had a kind of veil of sadness over it, and it wasn't really properly inhabited. Although it was a very beautiful old house with fields around it. I very much enjoyed living in the countryside. But there was this feeling of sadness as soon as we'd moved there. You see, that it was after the tragedy.
And so your brother drowned on your birthday.
Yes, which a friend of mine, unfortunately, who lived down in Soho, New York, she once said to me, "He ruined your birthday," which I had never quite put it like that myself. But every time my birthday was about to happen, I kind of got a feeling of dread.
You were pretty close to him, it looks like, from the photographs. But after his death, nobody really dealt with that with you, and you began to hate him.
I suppose in those days, people didn't deal in the same way with children's bereavement. The fact is, my brother was my closest companion. We were very close in age, 18 months apart. We were always together. We did everything together.
So then after his death, your mom retreated.
Yes, she was extremely depressed, and a great friend of hers who I spoke to, unfortunately, has now died, one of her oldest friends. She thought my mother had had a nervous breakdown after a child's death, mm-hmm. but no one ever said that. Obviously, I was only seven or eight, so.
So a lot of the early part of the book, before you get into some of your mother's history that you discovered, has to do with her alcoholism. What have you thought about in terms of growing up with two parents who are alcoholics? How has that impacted you and your life?
Well, I didn't know that it seems extraordinary, but I didn't know that my father was alcoholic until he died, age 64, of cirrhosis of the liver. I was 24. I suppose he was one of those men who drank from a very early age. They drank in the Navy, I know a great deal. He was commanding destroyers most of the war. And he must have held his drink in a way that my mother didn't. My mother had a very light head. She got drunk almost immediately. She became very maudlin, rather embarrassing, talking in a sentimental way, which I hated. So that impacted more on me. My mother's behaviour under drink was much more extreme, and other people could see it. And after my father died, she went downhill. Although they were in a way incompatible, she was very, very dependent on him. I think she loved him more than she thought. She could not live on her own. She was very bad at it, and she drank more and more.
Then how was her descent into Alzheimer's? You speak about that in the book. What was that like? I mean, I know that, you begin to think about, how do you fit into this picture? What do you owe your parent, and what do you owe yourself? I wonder if any of those questions were things that came up for you.
Well, the last thing is very interesting, what you said. What do you owe your parent? What do you owe yourself? I think the alcoholism, until I was sent to a therapist who specialised in alcoholism, I didn't know anything about codependency, so I kind of felt, you have to run around the person who's falling over drunk, breaking limbs. You feel you've got to help them, but she made me see it in more perspective. As for the Alzheimer's, in some ways, because my mother had carers, in some ways it was a relief because she could no longer drink. What do you owe your parents? It's a very interesting question. I kept with my mother till the end. I kept visiting her, and I suppose I was loyal to her in my own way. I visited her a lot, and my children came with me often as well. But all the time I was visiting her with the Alzheimer's, I was, well, 97 I found the diaries. Most of that time I was still reading the diaries, which was, she was like a companion to me through her diaries in a way she had not been in life.
Elisa Seagrave, her book is The Girl from Station X.
So talk more about those diaries. Where did you discover them and what did you feel when you first came across them?
I think it may have been one of the war diaries I opened first. I was the most incredible excitement. It was like I was almost delirious. I was giddy with excitement. And after a few weeks, I went through them. I was opening them at random and finding different things. And I think the war diaries were, in a way, the most exciting, because here was this whole life of 6 years of my mother's life as a working woman. She had six jobs in intelligence by the end of the war. This is a totally different person from anyone I had known. She was totally different. I began to admire her for some of the work she did.
So tell us about what she did. In 1939, she volunteered to go and work for the war effort. How did she start out?
Well, she started with very menial jobs. She'd only had a rather smart education at finishing school. She did not have a further education. So she started with very menial jobs. She was listing uniforms. After a few weeks, she then drove a car from... She lived in central London, was the office of this WAF. She drove cars out to balloon barrage sites, driving officers out. She had to clean the car, check the engines, deal with the tyres, all that sort of thing. Which I suppose in a way she was quite suited to, because she'd always been very interested in cars, and because the family were well off, she had had a car rather early on. They'd had family cars and she was interested. I think maybe the chauffeur had taught her certain things. Anyway, she definitely pitched in with this and she found the whole thing very, very interesting. She was extremely impressed by the people she met who had not had such privileged lives. My mother, one very good quality was she had great humility. She would never put herself forward in any way or think she was better than anybody. She made friends with every person, every walk of life. You know, I was brought up with all kinds of different people that she'd met in the war and remained friends with.
And some of them were men, and she seemed to have a lot of suitors.
Yes, she was obviously rather good-looking and glamorous. She was very, very popular with these men. They kept trying to marry her. Often in the diary, she'd complain that she was still not married, because several of her girlfriends had married during the war. In the course of the war, they got married and engaged. But she was too picky, I think. That may have been one of the reasons. She was too picky. She did fall in love briefly with this very handsome South African pilot she met at Bomber Command, but the whole thing went pear-shaped, and she sort of rejected him, and he married someone else. And she also was in a broken engagement rather early on. I think it ended in late 1941. She was engaged to someone she didn't appear to know very well, and I wonder if it was something to do with pleasing her own mother that she took up with this young man. She thought it was the right thing, you know, to marry. I don't think she was in love with him.
One of the things that's really striking in the book is how a number of her different suitors, the most serious ones, really seem to have suffered from PTSD, from post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of the war. I mean, they became quite disturbed emotionally and kind of brought that to her in the relationship, and she didn't know how to handle it.
That's a very, very interesting point. They were quite young, those two men that you're talking about. It was the pilot and also the fiancé. The doctor, my grandmother each time actually had to call the doctor. They were both at my grandmother's house separately when these sort of things were brought to a head, when the engagement was broken. The doctor said that the fiancé had been under too much stress at sea. But the interesting thing was, he then said, oh, he was being given the new command of a different ship. He was a very young man. And the doctor said, oh, this might see him through with a new command. I mean, so nowadays you'd think, oh, that perhaps they should go to hospital or something for a while. And then the other man was flying planes and bombing Germany. And the casualty rate, of course, was very high. My mother, of course, was hostile to men in a way. She didn't have, as her brother had died, you know, when she was so young, she didn't have much experience, really, how to deal with men. I think that was one of the problems.
your mother's brother died and your brother died.
Yes, yes. I mean, it only occurred to me very late on while I was doing the book that the parallel, for some reason, it never occurred to me before of this parallel. My mother, of course, wouldn't have known the little boy in the same way as a companion because he was disabled. He never sat up. But when I found her teenage diaries, I found that was very poignant. It was a moment when I started to feel the most sympathy for my mother when she wrote about the little brother. And I realised it hit her very deeply, the death of this little boy. And I think the fact that my grandmother was just widowed, the whole thing was kind of buried. My grandmother went away. I think she may have almost had a breakdown. She went to work for a charitable thing, the Mesopotamia Comforts Fund, and left the two children with her sister. And then the little boy died. I can't remember now whether she went away after the death of her husband, but there was an absence of my grandmother, as well as the death of my mother's father and the little brother. And then the absence, the physical absence of my grandmother, must have all been very difficult for her in early life.
Yeah, and maybe leading to some of the problems that she had later on.
Yes, I've read recently something about hoarding. My mother was a hoarder, and I think it is often a symptom of someone who's very isolated and lonely. She attached a great deal of importance to her possessions.
And also lack of control, a sense that you have no control, so you're desperate to control the only thing you can, which is your things.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Yes, of course, that's right. Yes, yes. She didn't feel she was in control at all when I knew her. She never gave the impression at all that she knew what she was doing. She gave the impression of being a child very much at sea in life.
But a completely different person that you discovered. How did she go to work for Bletchley Park? And talk about that. I mean, Bletchley Park was the precursor to the British Intelligence Service, basically. It was kind of like our CIA.
Yes. This friend of hers, who I never heard of again, got her an interview. She spoke quite good Italian because of this finishing school. She was first put in a hut as an indexer. And during the period of the Allied invasion of North Africa, leading up to it from July 42 to November 42, my mother was suddenly given a very good job in her hut above the other women working there. And this she remained very, very proud of for the rest of her life. But the interesting thing was that at the time, she actually wrote in the diary, "I will never have such an important job again." I found that very poignant.
And so what was her work like at Bletchley, and how critical was it?
It's quite confusing for me to summarise it in a few sentences. The Operation Torch thing, she was kind of amalgamating information. She was going to the next, getting information, checking it from the next door hut. It was to do with stopping supplies going through to Rommel in Africa. And she had to check reports going through and check indexes all the time. And you had to tell what was important. I think it was a process of selecting important things very, very quickly. Important information should be passed on. I'm abbreviating. It's quite complicated to explain it quickly. But she had to exercise great intelligence, but also very quick judgment, which that's why I was so excited, because my mother had not shown this kind of thing to me in life. She'd had to keep her head. She found it a terrible strain, but I think actually now one reads about it, I think a lot of the other people found it a strain at Bletchley. Some of them also took sick leave and things because it was such a responsible thing they were doing.
So she was an intelligence analyst.
Yes, exactly. That was for a few months. And then she left Bletchley after she'd had this very good job. She could have gone on there. But unfortunately, her character was always escapist, always the grass was greener. She kept trying to leave. Eventually, she did leave, which soon after she left in April 43, they stopped people leaving, I gather. But then I think later she regretted it. She often wrote in the diary she was impressed by having worked at a place like that. And she went back on visits. And I think out of the whole war, that was her most impressive job. But she kept complaining in the diary while she was there. And she said how much she preferred working on the bomber stations. She was very interested in planes flying and I suppose, and also in Bletchley there were a lot of male academics, which she hadn't encountered, and she preferred being with the men of action, the pilots. She took against a lot of these male academics. She thought they were rather conceited.
So how did this change your feeling about your mother? I don't mean so much in an intellectual sense, but in a more gut or emotional sense.
It changed my feeling about her because the diaries went back so far. I felt I was kind of going through her life with her. So I was almost like a companion, like I was, as a teenager, again, with my mother. I was almost envious of some of the war experiences, which sounds rather odd. But, for example, at the end of the war, she stayed on for 6 months in the WAF. She was sent into post-war Germany, where she had a love affair with an American who was working for Eisenhower. And that kind of side of her life I found extremely exciting, and I had identified with that. So it was emotionally, it was, yes, her childhood, I was sympathetic to her early childhood with the tragedies, and then I identified with this very exciting life she'd had as a young woman.
And what did that do to the more uncomfortable feelings that you had about your mother, the anger that you had and the sense of rejection?
I kind of almost forgave her. I totally forgave her. And if, you know, if people would criticise my mother now, I would defend her, giving examples of how difficult her life had been, and also her fragility, actually. She was a fragile character. I would defend her, and the fact I'd made the journey with her, she stayed alive while I read all the diaries. I went to her at the old people's home where she went for the last 1.5 years of her life, and I put my arm on her and I said, well done for writing the diaries. Of course, I don't know if she understood or not, but that was a very important thing for me to say to her.
Elisa Seagrave. Her book is The Girl from Station X. Next up, we hear another story about another figure involved in the British Intelligence Service during World War II, as we replay our 2008 interview with Jenna Conant about her book, The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington. Roald Dahl is best known as a wildly successful writer of children's books, such as Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and James and the Giant Peach. But before he wrote books for kids, he was a British spy in Washington, D.C. during the Second World War. Dashing and handsome, the former RAF pilot used his charm to invade the upper reaches of the U.S. government and Georgetown society. There he won friends and influenced politicians to back the British war effort and sabotage those who were less enthusiastic about the war. Dahl cut his budding literary teeth on writing colorful propaganda pieces published in leading American popular magazines that helped to gain public support for the war. My guest, Jeanette Conant, is the author of the 2002 New York Times bestseller Tuxedo Park, A Wall Street Tycoon and the Secret Palace of Science That Changed the Course of World War II. Now she continues her fascination with the lesser-known corners of America's involvement in that war with her new book, The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington. Jeanette Conant, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Now, your book, The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington, I'm going to start over again, and we're taping, so you can, start over anytime you want to.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, I'm going to start a different way.
All right.
So Roald Dahl, we all know Roald Dahl as the author of wonderful kids' books like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. But until he got here as a member of the British effort to influence the U.S. to enter World War II, he never even thought to become a writer.
That's right. He was sort of bungled into spying as much as he bungled into his career as an author.
I gotta stop you. Sorry.
Okay.
Are you using a microphone?
No, I'm just speaking into the phone.
You are just speaking into the phone. Okay, because I'm getting a lot of, mouth noises.
Oh, should I just back it up a little bit like that, so I'm not so close?
That's much better.
Okay.
Okay, good. Start again then. So he never even thought to become a writer.
That's right. He bungled into becoming a spy the same way he bungled into becoming an author. He was just a young man who went off to seek adventure. He was working in Africa when the war broke out, and he joined the RAF and became a pilot. And like so many young men at the time, he was doing his patriotic duty. But he was very badly injured very early in the war. He crashed, and he was invalided out of the service, and he found himself at the start of the war behind a desk, and he wanted more adventure than that. So he took a job in Washington, D.C. when it was offered to him, working for the British Embassy. And his job was to be a propagandist, to write material about his adventures as an RAF pilot that inspired the Americans with a feeling of patriotism and fanned the flames of enthusiasm, you know, for war and fighting and defending England. And he was so good at it that he started getting offered lots of jobs writing magazine articles for things like the Saturday Evening Post and popular magazines. And he sort of discovered that he had this ability as a writer and started to entertain the notion that maybe he could make a living at it when the war was over.
And he got some encouragement as well. He had a mentor here.
He did. Well, the funny thing is, one of the first things he was asked to do was to go have lunch with C.S. Forster, the famous British novelist who'd written the Hornblower series and was beloved by Britons everywhere. And C.S. Forster just interviewed him about his experiences as an RAF pilot and his crash and was going to write it up for the Saturday Evening Post. But they had so much to drink at lunch that Forster said, you know, look, go home, type up your memories, send me some rough notes, and then I'll write a great piece for you. And Dahl sent over his notes, and they were so good that Forster said, look, you know, this is a finished piece. I'm just going to submit it under your name. And that's really how he got his start. The funny thing about that article was that it ran under the title Shot Down Over Libya, and it was published to great fanfare in the Saturday Evening Post. But in fact, Roald Dahl had exaggerated, as many young men are wont to do when they're trying to impress not only an older man but a famous novelist. He was not shot down by the Germans over Libya. He'd actually gotten lost and run out of fuel and crashed his plane in the desert at night. So later in his career, he had to correct that story and make it more truthful.
Uh-huh. So the memoir was already fictionalized just a bit.
Well, that happens.
It does.
More often than not, as we know.
That's right. You're listening to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon, and you're hearing my 2008 interview with Jenna Conant about her book, The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington. Stay tuned for more after the break.
When they begin, the begin, it brings back the sound of music so tender. It brings back a night of tropical splendor. It brings back a memory evergreen. I'm with you once more under the stars. Down by the shore, an orchestra's playing. Even the palms seem to be swaying when they begin the begin.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're listening back to my 2008 interview with Jenna Conant about her book, The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington. Dahl was sent to Washington, D.C. before Pearl Harbor by British intelligence to spy on the Americans. It was part of the British effort to get FDR into the war on the Allied side. So now, why was he tapped for this mission? What was it about Roald Dahl that the British saw in him and thought he'd be a good person to send to Washington for?
Well, he was actually just sent to Washington, as I said, as a propagandist. He was so good looking. He was 6'6", and he looked like the emblematic sort of matinee idol, you know, a Hollywood version of a British war hero. And his job was to go to Washington and be a goodwill ambassador and sort of shake congressmen's hands and kiss their wives and wave the flag and, you know, raise money for the widows and orphans back home. That's how he started. He hated that job. He found it very embarrassing. He said that he found himself trapped in a cocktail mob in America, going to parties and shaking hands. He hated it. And he was so rude and mischievous and outspoken that he got fired. And he was about to be sent back to London when British intelligence scooped him up. And as Sir William Stevenson, who's a famous spy, is known by his wartime cable address, Intrepid, would later say of Dahl that they thought they'd take a chance on him because they thought nobody that badly behaved would ever be suspected of being a spy. So Stevenson hired him and decided to see if they couldn't turn this good-looking, clever, but somewhat mischievous Brit into an agent working in Washington for British intelligence.
And they did a pretty good job of it. And now, as you say, he was mischievous, he was handsome, he was sexy. He was a real hit among the Washington, D.C. glitterati, and especially the ladies.
Well, you know, part of his responsibility was sort of to go out on the town and talk up the rich and the powerful. And Washington was teeming with people. It was the center of action during the war. All the dollar-a-year men, that's all the Wall Street tycoons and millionaires, you know, they went to work for Roosevelt for for what they called the dollar a year, essentially for free, donating their services and their connections and their time to the country at time of war. And they headed up a lot of the important war boards. Their wives were all in town. Everybody was obviously very political and volunteering for all kinds of work. So there was a lot going on in Washington, and there were a lot of women, wealthy women, important women, whose husbands were otherwise occupied. One of them was Claire Booth Luce. She was the very beautiful wife of Henry Luce, who was the owner and publisher of Time Life. He was very conservative, Republican, anti-intervention, against helping England and getting entwined in the war, and he was an outspoken critic of Roosevelt, who was, as we know, Churchill's great ally. So Dahl was assigned to sort of keep tabs on Mrs. Luce. She thought he was terribly handsome, took him home to her hotel room one night, and he's, as he would later claim, kept him there for 3 days. And when he went back to the embassy and reported on their pillow talk, which was his job, and complained that this was above and beyond the call of duty, he would say that the ambassador would sort of later sort of tell him those immortal words, you know, close your eyes and think of your crown and country. Carry on, young man. So, yes, not only was he a hit with the ladies, but he did rather caddishly report back on everything they said to British intelligence, but that was his job, so.
The Mata Hari of the British intelligence spy ring.
Yes, it just goes to show that men do it, too.
Now, why did the British feel this was so necessary? Tell us about there was a fairly strong isolationist movement. Talk about that. Who were some of the leading figures of it, and what was the politics behind it?
Well, what most people forget was that this country did not want any part of this new world war. We had been dragged into World War I. Most Americans never understood what that war was about, except that we sent our boys over and that a lot of them died, and that Europe never then paid back their war debts, and that we picked up the tab, and that people were very bitter about that. So when Europe became embroiled in another war in the late 30s, and we started having newspaper reports of it, it was called in our newspapers the European conflict, and the country was overwhelmingly against lifting a hand to help Europe. They felt that this was just another mess and that they had to clean up their own mess this time. By 1940, 98% of the country was diametrically opposed to getting involved, and so much so that Roosevelt, who was a friend of Churchill's, who very much wanted to come to England's defense as the Germans started bombing England, was told by his advisors that if he was seen as doing anything publicly to come to England's aid, he would risk re-election. The Lend-Lease Bill, which he had tried to cobble together to come together with food and support and money, not military aid, but other kinds of aid for England, was mired in Congress. Didn't look like it was going to pass. There were a lot of very famous Americans like Charles Lindbergh, Senator Hamilton Fish, others who gave talks to huge rallies talking about why intervening was a bad idea and the country shouldn't do it. They had a group called the America First organization, which was enormously popular, nationalist organization, which was opposed to intervention in the war, very critical of Roosevelt. So the British, who were faced with imminent invasion, they were being bombed nightly by the Germans. The German troops were beginning to organize just 20 miles from their shore, and most people thought that invasion was just a few weeks away. Remember that the Germans had marched straight through Europe in the late 30s, and England was their next goal. So they were quite desperate, and they sent the spies over to this country to try and quell this isolationist movement and to turn it around and try and begin to organize support for coming to England's aid. Churchill knew that if America didn't help them, they would certainly fall to the Nazi blitzkrieg. They didn't stand a chance on their own.
And I'm going to pause for just a minute to remind our listeners that we're talking with Jeanette Conant. She's the author of the new book, The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington, and also the author of two previous books on World War II, Tuxedo Park and 109 East Palace. Now, back, you mentioned Charles Lindbergh. There were some real dirty tricks done against him. Talk about that.
Well, you know, when the Irregulars first came over, their job was to weaken this isolationist movement, to target Nazi sympathizers, and do everything they had to do, no matter how ruthless or devious, to expose them, to undermine them, to eliminate them. And it's not pretty, but remember, the British were absolutely desperate. They had to turn the tide of American public opinion pro-intervening in the war and pro-Britain. So they did all kinds of things. They planted stories in the American press about how they were in cahoots with the Nazis, these various American figures. In the case of Lindbergh, you know, he was very popular. He was this huge a hero, and he would have these big rallies in Madison Square Garden. Well, the Irregulars went in, for example, once, and they bought all the tickets for the rally. They threw all those out, and then they had their own people giving away tickets, giving a different time and location for the rally so that nobody would show up for the real thing. They printed all kinds of nasty.
Hold on. I totally lost you right there. Could you repeat that sentence?
Yeah, hang on. This is my what do you call it?
Call waiting. Call
It'll
waiting.
Stop in just a second.
That's great.
Okay.
So where were you?
So the Irregulars would smear isolationist senators if they found out that an isolationist senator, for example, had a mistress. They would see that this was peddled to the American press. They would call up a Drew Pearson or a Walter Winchell, very powerful and influential gossip columnists in their day, and they would leak this kind of information to them so that it would be on their popular radio broadcasts or their syndicated columns, and they would blacken the name of isolationist senators that way. They did everything they could to weaken the isolationist cause, and they were incredibly effective at working the American press and converting this country to interventionism.
Well, I want to come back to that, but first I want to ask, you know, I always have been under the impression that Lindbergh was in cahoots with the Nazis. Was he, or was this just British propaganda? Oops. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Was he, or...
Hang on, that's the call waiting again.
Yeah, that's okay. Do you want to take that call and just tell him?
No, it'll go away.
Okay. So was he in cahoots with the Nazis, or was that just British propaganda?
It wasn't just British propaganda. To say he was in cahoots with the Nazis is perhaps too strong, but he was somewhat smitten with the Third Reich. You know, he had seen the terrible death toll in World War I. He knew how organized the German Air Force was. He had, in some sense, a healthy respect for the Luftwaffe. To some extent, that Germany had been decimated after World War.
You'll have to say that one again. To some extent, I lost the words before that.
To some extent, he felt that the Third Reich was restoring order to Germany. that had been decimated after World War One, and that he also had a healthy respect of the Luftwaffe and a real sense of the danger, of the death toll that would be involved in taking on the superior Air Force a second time. He was really familiar firsthand with the terrible death toll in World War One. So I think it was a revulsion against war and a healthy respect for the Third Reich that unfortunately turned him towards this position that just destroyed his name and his legacy in the United States.
You know, of course, I understand why the British would want to do this. None of us would have wanted, I mean, in some way the U.S. did save the world from Nazism. At least that's what the history books tell us. Although actually the Soviet Union had, if anything, a larger role in destroying the Nazi, in destroying the Wehrmacht. But what do you think about the prosecution? You know, what do you think about these dirty tricks, this campaign of propaganda and political subversion? What about some of the ethical issues?
Well, you know, in time of war, the question is, does the end justify the means? From the British perspective, looking at imminent invasion, their cities being absolutely blitzed nightly, there was no question of ethics anymore. It was a question of life or death. They were going to do anything it took to get the help they needed to survive.
But what about
that's what they did.
What about your position, though? I mean, we went to war under what's pretty well understood false pretenses here in 2003. There were journalists who were pumping up that war. Judith Miller comes to mind.
Yes, that's what inspired me to write this book. What really inspired me to write this book was, in some sense, our country's naivete. We think we are told the reasons we're going for war, but we, as a democracy, are somewhat naive about the effect to which our own press can be manipulated, about the extent to which foreign intelligence cannot be relied on, and to the extent to which there are super lobbyists who come to this country and would convince us, you know, essentially trick us into going to war for reasons that we think are right and noble, and really have to do with the basic, brass tacks wallet issues, perhaps, like oil, more than freedom. I was being mischievous in writing this book, but I learned a lot in the process myself. And as a democracy, we have to grow up and be a little bit more wary and a little bit more sensible about our role in the world. That said, I think in retrospect, World War II was judged a just war, if a war can be judged so. And even though we were pushed into that war to some extent by the British, I think history judges that perhaps that was the best thing and that it was right and good that we stepped in when we did and stopped the Nazis in their tracks and that more people weren't killed. I mean, the death toll was horrendous enough as it was, and this was an outright evil that had to be ended. But certainly the means by which the British accomplished that were devious and underhanded, to say the least, and so much so, of course, that that special relationship between Churchill and Roosevelt and perhaps between our two countries would never be the same again.
Would never be the same again?
No, after World War II, you know, the OSS, the Foreign Intelligence Organization that the British helped us organize, was purged of the British influence and rechristened the CIA, and there was great tension between our two countries, a certain tension and distrust that remains to this day.
Yeah, and actually has been written about in terms of the Iraq War as well, But let's talk now, and I'm talking with Jeanette Conant about The Irregulars. That's her latest book, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington. Now, let's talk about what Dahl did as part of this campaign of propaganda and subversion. He got very close to Eleanor Roosevelt. How did he exploit that relationship?
Well, one of the stories he wrote for one of the American magazines was about small cartoon figures that plague. They're called gremlins that plague the planes of RAF pilots and force them to crash. It was really one of those sort of sweet, touching stories that women would read to their children and would be part of the war effort to create and arouse sympathy for the British soldiers and pilots. And it was very effective. Disney liked it. A lot of the Disney cartoon characters, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck, were making movies in newsreels for the war effort for morale-boosting types of messages. So Disney bought Dahl's book and published a short children's version of it. It was very successful. Eleanor Roosevelt read it to her grandchildren, loved it. And when she heard this author, the young pilot who had been wounded in the war, was in Washington, she invited him to dinner at the White House. Well, she was so charmed by Dahl, she started inviting him to the White House on a regular basis. He started having dinner with her and the president, and then she started inviting him to Hyde Park, the family's country retreat, very private reserve for the Roosevelts in New York. And he had unparalleled access to the president and first lady in these settings. And he would be privy to all kinds of conversations about the war, about Roosevelt's feelings about Churchill, about his feelings towards running for re-election. As most people remember, he ran for an unprecedented third term and then an unprecedented fourth term, Roosevelt, all while he was very ill. The British, of course, were obsessed with Roosevelt's health, whether he would live through his terms and continue to help the British. So Roald Dahl would type up everything he heard and saw on these outings and file it back to his British superiors, and a number of these intelligence reports are in the book. And it's quite a remarkable record of sort of spying by a very young man, an amateur spy at that. So it's just interesting the extent to which the British went to keep tabs on the Roosevelts, their shifting emotions and loyalties.
And FDR himself, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, figured out fairly soon that Dahl was a British agent, but he used him as much as Dahl used FDR.
Yes, FDR, you know, had made the decision early on to let in these British spies. We were, when he first let them in 1940, the first group, we were at that point still isolationist, and it was in violation of the Monroe Doctrine, letting these British spies in on U.S. soil. He did so. He told Hoover, the head of the FBI, to look the other way, and he invited the British in. It was sort of what he felt was the least he could do. His hands were tied in terms of getting them any kind of military aid at that point, but he wanted to let them in and at least root out sort of Nazi sympathizers and that sort of thing. Of course, the British took that mandate and ran with it and did much more. But Roosevelt was very much aware that they were here and what they were up to. So when Dahl, you know, very articulate, very clever, quick-witted young man, started turning up all the time at his table, he was no fool. He certainly suspected that Dahl was a spy. And in fact, would sometimes, according to Dahl, float ideas, sort of make statements about policy or certain statements that were clearly aimed at Churchill, and he knew certainly well that Dahl was filing them back, probably to William Stevenson, his boss, the head of the irregulars, and would find their way back to Churchill. So he used Dahl as a sort of back-channel conduit of information.
And Dahl also interfered basically in the... In the 1944 election with Henry Wallace. Yeah, talk about that.
Well, Henry Wallace was
And tell us who Henry Wallace was.
Henry Wallace was Roosevelt's vice president during his third term. He was a very strange vice president, really. He was an intellectual. He was a scientist. He had re-engineered various strains of corn to make them hardier. But he'd been a hero of the farmer in the Midwest. He had reorganized the agriculture department and helped pull us out of the Depression. He was a beloved figure to farmers, as I said. So Roosevelt put him on the ticket to help him get elected during his very controversial bid for a third term in office. And he was on the ticket for his fourth term. But Wallace was very eccentric. He had all kinds of strange religious notions. He was something of a mystic. He had followed a Russian guru for a while, and he was very, very left-wing. He had all kinds of sort of ideas that flirted with socialism. Among his ideas, he was a radically anti-empire. And every time he gave a speech, he criticized Churchill's far-flung British empire and said how the British should let all their colonies free and give them the vote. So Churchill loathed Henry Wallace. And the British, who, as I said, had been keeping very close tabs on FDR, had a very keen sense that his health was failing, much more than the Americans knew from their own press, worried that he would not survive his fourth term, and were afraid that Wallace would be a terrible president if he took office and Roosevelt should die. So the British were determined to get him off the ticket and started conspiring behind the scenes to have Wallace removed. They lobbied very hard with Roosevelt's Democratic advisors to have him removed from the ticket. They smeared him in the press. They dug up a lot of dirt on his background, including letters they found that he had written to this Russian guru, which they threatened to make public. All kinds of stories were planted about Wallace's kooky religious notions, making him seem very eccentric, very flaky and unreliable. And they succeeded in having Wallace removed from the Democratic ticket in a very controversial and emotional Republican convention in Chicago in 1944, and an unsuspecting Harry Truman was drafted at the last moment. So the British congratulated themselves on that little bit of skullduggery, which very much changed American history.
And, you know, you didn't mention an even earlier act of skullduggery. That was a false map showing that purportedly Hitler intended to take over the Americas.
Well, that was one of the early efforts by the irregulars to push this country into war. And they created a false map, which they sort of allowed the FBI to stumble onto. And this false map showed the Nazis infiltrating South America and sitting on our borders ready to invade. And it was a map that Roosevelt would cite in a speech trying to arouse the American public into feeling that charging into this war was the right thing. So that was all part of their vast propaganda effort to convert this country into a pro-Britain, pro-war attitude.
Now, you call the book The Irregulars, and we have to say it wasn't just Roald Dahl. Tell us, first of all, why the name The Irregulars, and who were some of the other characters in this stable?
Well, this spy ring was cobbled together from all kinds of strange people because, as I said, it was a secret espionage effort in the United States, a kind of an underground effort. And William Stevenson, who came over here, himself was an amateur. He was not a traditional British spy. He was, in fact, a self-made millionaire. He was Canadian by birth. He had all kinds of ties in finance and industry here, so Churchill sent him over to start it. And he hired people like himself from finance and industry, people who from academe, and a lot of the people he hired were already here and had likely cover stories like Roald Dahl. But among the people he hired were David Ogilvy. David Ogilvy went on to become very famous as the head of Ogilvy & Mather, a famous advertising firm, but at the time he was working for the Gallup poll organization. The British had him start leaking early sensitive poll results on American elections, and FDR used Gallup to do a lot of sensitive polling at the time, and David Ogilvy leaked all this to the British, and then later the British hired him full-time to do their own kind of manipulation of the American public and American polls. Also, there were people like Noel Coward, the famous, as he called himself, song and dance man. Noel Coward traveled all over the world, met a lot of heads of state, doing all kinds of morale-boosting troop tours, and he would carry documents and do small jobs for William Stevenson. There was Leslie Howard. Most people remember him from Gone with the Wind. He was, in fact, shot down by the Germans during the war, and most famously, Ian Fleming was a former journalist. He was too old to get a job at the front, but he wanted to do something. He joined Naval Intelligence and then was recruited by William Stevenson to come work in Washington and help manipulate the Americans as part of this effort. And all of these characters, these amateurs who came from different walks of life, they referred to themselves as the Irregulars because, as I said, they weren't career Secret Service guys, and they like to think of themselves as the same as the Baker Street Irregulars, the famous amateur street urchins that helped Sherlock Holmes in his stories. So they took to calling themselves as the Irregulars during the war.
And, of course, Ian Fleming of the famous 007 novels,
the James Bond
novels, which had he put in a number of real-life people in as characters in his stories, you say.
All the James Bond stories and characters were drawn from Fleming's years in intelligence and his experiences very much. I mean, he borrowed directly from his experiences working for the irregulars in New York and Washington.
Now, these folks went on, of course, to, as you say, to have some pretty illustrious post-war careers. You mentioned before Bill Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, who set up the OSS, and that became the CIA, and Ogilvie, who became a big advertising mogul. How did their wartime exploits of these men prefigure the post-war world?
Well, I came to the conclusion that being trained in the art of manipulation, deception, and obfuscation is great for civilian life. They all became millionaires, and very quickly, too. You know, David Ogilvie's first advertising campaign was the man in the Hathaway shirt. It showed a mysterious kind of intelligence agent with an eye patch. It caught the imagination of the American public. It was a huge hit, and Ogilvie, hit the ground running and became an enormously successful advertising tycoon. I mean, one of the most successful who ever lived. Ian Fleming, of course, wrote the first Bond book, Casino Royale. It was based very much on some of the things he had seen in New York while working in Rockefeller Center, where William Stevenson and the Irregulars' headquarters was based. And that book was a huge success, and then Fleming became enormously successful. Dahl wrote short stories throughout the 1950s and became a very celebrated literary figure, and then, of course, turned to writing children's fiction and became, you know, almost the precursor to Harry Potter, just one of the best-selling children's authors of all time. And it's interesting to me that all three men stayed very close friends. They continued to see each other regularly, and they stayed in very close touch with their mentor, Sir William Stevenson, who was the head of the Irregulars, who was already a millionaire before the war and made many millions afterwards in various business ventures with some of his former spies. So they all did good during the war and right well afterwards.
Now, I wanted to ask you a question about your research. You found a cache of never-before-seen letters of Dahl's that really helped you in doing this work. How did you find them? What were they?
Well, I like to work from original sources whenever I do a book. I had seen a mention in an old out-of-print espionage book that Roald Dahl had been a spy, and I started poking around looking for material. I didn't have high hopes because trying to find records from spies is difficult at best. And then I was incredibly fortunate to stumble across a close friendship he had made with an American millionaire, a kind of a mini Citizen Kane type figure who had owned a string of newspapers in the United States and been a powerful publisher. His name was Charles Marsh. And he and Marsh had become great friends and had written each other, you know, several times during the week, right through the war. And it turned out that the Marsh family had all of these papers, diaries, memos, all kinds of documents of Dahl's, because the two men had remained lifelong friends. And Charles Marsh, who was incredibly wealthy, had been a patron of Dahl, an early supporter of him when he was a struggling writer. So fascinatingly, they had sort of been lost and then found, and the family gave them to me. And it was just a huge cache of unpublished wartime records. And the book is based on all those letters and diaries and memos.
And the book is The Irregulars, Roald Dahl and the British Spy Ring in Wartime Washington. We've been speaking with Jeanette Conant, the author. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Conant's previous two books about World War II are Tuxedo Park and 109 East Palace. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.